IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast supported by Pragati, a flagship media initiative of the Takshashila Institution. We're a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like to bring a fresh perspective to Indian affairs and an Indian perspective to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to the 1000th episode of All Things Policy. I am Pranay and today I have with me Nitin, who's the Bhishma Pitama of this podcast. Why, I will tell you just now. So this podcast began in around Jan 2019. And first of all, this podcast room that we are sitting in at the Takshashila Institution, that was made by Nitin. And there are many innovations which you wouldn't see because this is an audio podcast. But if you ever come to our office, you will see what new things have been made to make this cost efficient and yet it works fine, right? So that was the thing. And in 2019, I remember Nitin, we were having this conversation on our high table that we are having these interesting conversations, but we are not able to get people outside Takshashila Institution into the conversation. And then Nitin had this idea that why don't we do a daily podcast? And at that point of time, we were like, what a preposterous idea. How will we do a podcast every single day? And we were very scared, but we said, let's try. And lo and behold, we are here on the 1000th episode. So I don't think we've missed any day. I think maybe one or two days, etc. But apart from that, this has been a team effort. Everyone has pitched in and listeners have been plugged into this conversation. And we've had 1000 episodes here. So what does that make you feel, Nitin?
Pranay, first of all, I refuse to accept the charge of being a pitama. I'm a pita. I have 3 children. And I still consider myself a young person, although now my children dispute that finding. And I certainly don't have a long white beard. And I certainly don't want to lie down on a bed of arrows giving gyan to people. You know, in fact, that Shanti Parva always troubled me a lot. Because here's this old man who's prepared to die, waiting to die, lying on a bed of arrows. Obviously, it's very painful. And his descendants, his nephews, and all these descendants come up to him and ask him all sorts of questions about what's the meaning of life, how do I rule a kingdom? And, you know, Bhishma Pitamaha, you know, generously and patiently answers all those questions. You know, if I was lying on a bed of arrows and my descendants came and asked me for, you know, questions like that, you know, I probably would have had 1 or 2 four-letter words to tell them.
Yeah. Right?
But anyway, wrong. So I would be as far away from the Pitamaha category as possible. But, you know, I'm really thrilled about the 1000th episode. You know, I didn't even know that it was a 1000th episode until Aditya and you came and mentioned this a couple of weeks ago. Because I thought just recently we'd done 500. And when we'd done 500, I thought, okay, that's about less than 2 years. So it's not a big deal. You know, it's not a big deal. I mean, we just do 2 years of into the game. But I think the figure of 1000, 10 to the power of 3 somehow makes me think that, okay, this is something substantial. We must have a party. And I'm told that Manoj has arranged a nice big cake to celebrate the 1000th episode, 1000th continuous episode. And what gives me the joy is not just the fact that it is 1000 episodes, but 1000 excellent episodes, bringing almost everybody we've had at Takshashila into the room. So from interns to granddaddies have all been in the podcast in one way or the other. We've been able to feature really fresh new talent. We've been able to tap on ancient wisdom and everything in between. So I'm really thrilled that it's 1000. And I think after we eat the cake, now we should strive for the 10,000.
Yes, absolutely. We'll do that. So let's begin with today's conversation. What we thought we'll do today is look at how the world has changed in the last 3 years. And especially because you've been listening to some of the promo episodes where people at Takshashila have been talking about what have been the changes in their field of research or their field of focus. So we'll continue that conversation today and discuss how global realities have changed at a much broader sense. And in the second half of the episode, we'll take some listener questions that have come up over the past week or so. So let's begin with this, Nitin. You were talking about the fact that we have to assess global realities now. The world is not what it was even 2-3 years ago. And especially we started this podcast. The first episode I remember was on universal basic income. We had a quick conversation on that. And that was Jan 2019. So according to you, what are the big things that have changed from Jan 2019 ATP episode number one to Jan 2023 ATP episode number 1000?
Yeah, let's look at it in two ways. No, let's look at it as some incidents which are micro and then try and go back and zoom out and look at what's the macro change. I remember personally in early 2019, deeply thinking about the US-China trade war, which was sort of emerging at that time, and specifically the technological dimensions of that trade war. And at that time, I remember having written an article which says technology is going to be an important front in the US-China tech war. Mm. And underlying that story was the idea that we had already entered the information age. The industrial age was giving way to the information age. The world order, which obtained after the Second World War, was coming to an end. And we've been talking about it. I mean, since 2000, when we said that, look, if you don't accommodate India into the institutions of global governance, you are looking at an outdated system, whether it's the UN Security Council, the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty, anything that you can think of. And the fact that the powers that be didn't make that accommodation immediately, I mean, over a period of 20 years, which is immediate in history, led to the decline and ultimately, you could say, a crisis of the world order, which was there for since 1945, which also led to, you know, small skirmishes, military conflicts, etc. were happening. But the US-China confrontation was the big story at that time. Now, the related big story was 2019 was around the time when the world's governments figured out that the technology companies were becoming too big for their boots. Now, they had an incipient notion that social media platforms have political power, but they were quite unsure of how to go about governing them, you know, what to do about it. So some of the jurisdictions decided to pull out antitrust, you know, typical monopoly, anti-monopoly, pro-competition regulations and statutes, and started moving on that. Europe was doing that. United States was doing that. India had gotten upset with social media companies over issues of censorship or blocking content or lack thereof. And that was the story going on. Now, remember, this is about a year and a half after the India-China military outbreaks along the line of control, Doklam first and then the others later. All of this, if you were to zoom out, we could see that the old order was no longer holding up. People with power, countries that had power, even corporations that had power could cock a snook at the old world order and get away with whatever they wanted to do. The United States realized very clearly and in a bipartisan manner that for 25 to 30 years, they've been engaging China on a false prospectus, that the Chinese were not the Chinese which they imagined they were dealing with, but the Chinese had their own idea of what they want to do with the world order. And the United States realized that under Trump. And I think there was a bipartisan decision to take the Chinese on the front foot. Now, that boils down to a change in the rules-based order that we had. Mm. And that gave up and that now has given way to something which is very limited in terms of rules-based. A lot of it is power-based. And in a way, it's a throwback to a period when large powers, empires were taking a mercantilist approach and competing with other empires and great powers in a total fashion. You know, you're competing in politics, you're competing in economics, you're competing in technology, you're competing in terms of your diplomatic allies for global presence and power and so on. So the age of competition and contestation became a lot more serious in the last two to three years, to the position now where I think most of the baseline assumptions that we had in terms of how the world works and therefore what kind of policies a country should pursue are undergoing and have undergone significant change.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the world is more zero-sum thinking is more prevalent now than it was even 3 years.
Yeah, and that tells you something, no? That order and world order is a social construct.
Yeah.
It was not zero sum. We used to think that it's a positive sum game in 2019. Mm. And, you know, from roughly around 1999 to 2019, we thought it's non-zero sum. And therefore, it was non-zero sum.
Mm.
Now, people are beginning to think that it is zero sum. Mm. And therefore, it will become zero sum. Mm. So, in that sense, social constructs, you know, political reality, human affairs is a social construct.
Yeah, it's created in a sense. And yeah, especially when we were talking about US relations, right? So, when Trump was there in 2019, a lot of things were that maybe this is an aberration. This is just Trump being Trump. And maybe when a Democrat president comes, things will change. But as we've seen, the US-China confrontation has continued. In fact, on some axes, it has intensified, especially on the technology side. The kinds of things that the new president Biden has also done is something that even Trump hadn't done. So there is definitely a change, and a big change, where we, you know, in 2016 we were talking that maybe there might be a G2 thing that might happen. Maybe Obama and Xi Jinping might come to some sort of modus vivendi. But that hasn't happened at all, right? We've moved into another direction where there is a severe confrontation, not even co-opetition to an extent, but there is very strong idea of competing, and now actively in the tech domain, suppressing the other country before it becomes more powerful, rather than maintaining lead over it, right? So this is a big change, I guess. What else? What else?
You know, I was just remembering, you know, our book, India's Marathon, came out in 2019?
2020.
Yeah. 2020. Yeah, obviously, because it says remaking the post-pandemic order. Yeah. So, yeah. So, you know, the book, India's Marathon, which we started, I think, 2017-18 as an exercise, was actually trying to foresee this, right? That we tried to look at 80 scenarios, then we reduced it to 26. And when the book came out, I think there were 26 scenarios, and there were essays by very interesting people on India's Marathon, Ideas for a Post-Pandemic World Order, which is edited by Anirudh Pranay and with a cameo editing role from me. But I urge all of you listeners to go and look at that book. It's available online, and it tells you what kind of scenarios are possible, right? And it's important to read the book, because you can't narrate those 80 or 26 scenarios looking in a podcast, right? Analytically, it's best to look at the scenarios. I think it's still a very, very useful resource to look at how the world is changing and might change, because we are still in a state of flux. Although the old order is crumbling, it's not yet clear what that new order looks like, right? We have some working assumptions now in a state of flux, which basically says that world is zero sum. But this is a safety option, right? When you don't know which way, what kind of future you can expect, what you try and do is that you cover all your bases, you hedge your bets, you keep your friends close and your enemies closer and that kind of stuff, right? So you try to make everything at home, you try to keep all your options open, you play it very safe, which is what is happening now. So in that sense, it might be a transitionary moment where zero-sum thinking is something when you know, press the clutch to go into neutral when you're changing gears, right? You might change to a different gear. I think that's the neutral, you know, you've pressed the clutch, you're in neutral, and everybody is playing it very safe, going back to presumably safe, but because it involves zero-sum thinking, it's going to be less optimal than if you were engaging and trading and cooperating with others, right? I do think that humanity is not stupid, right? Although it's quite fashionable to say humans are stupid collectively. But humanity as a whole, I don't think is stupid, right? In the sense that after discovering the value of cooperation, free trade, individual liberty, liberal democracy, basic human rights, and a model where people can live together in harmony despite having differences, cooperate and trade with each other and achieve welfare for everybody, I think people are not stupid to lose that. So we have that 100 years of experience of, you know, where people live longer, people are healthier, per capita incomes are higher, people not only have enough to eat, but are becoming obese. Now, this is on a global average, also in an Indian context. Of course, there are 300 million poor people in the country who have been worse off because of the pandemic. But even otherwise, we know what the winning formula is. So I'm not convinced, and I don't buy this argument that, you know, this is going to be 100 years of a different order where we're going back to the pre-World War era, etc. I think it's an eclipse. It's a moment of transition, and people will want prosperity, better health from each other and from their governments. So it's a matter of time, whether it's 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, we don't know. But I think we are talking about that kind of time frame before, you know, the human ingenuity and a desire to have a better future kicks back. And then we might not go back to, certainly we will not go back to a pre-pandemic world order and a pre-pandemic political system. But the post-pandemic political system and post-pandemic world order will be one where you can expect individual liberty, democracy, free trade, and the good things in life to come back.
Yeah, so maybe we can call this interregnum world disorder for a brief period, and hopefully we'll figure out where the world goes over the next few years. Now, let's come to India itself, right? So, I remember in 2019, when we had a few episodes, the general frame and the tone of our episodes was that, you know, we have lost a decade, like Pooja Mehra's book talks about, economy is not going anywhere. So, there was generally a negative sentiment that, you know, a lot needs to be done. And then COVID happened, right? And we were even more pessimistic that how will we manage? But after COVID, the situation is, at least from a narrative sense, is very different, right? There is suddenly a talk about an India opportunity with zero COVID in China and things like that, right? So, what's this big change? How do you see it?
Yeah, you know, this is incredible India, right? Really incredible India, that you would expect that after a terrible decade, you know, Pooja Mehra is very right. It was a lost decade. We lost a complete decade where we could have fixed our economy, our healthcare, education, and all of those human indicators. We just frittered that opportunity away. And then comes a pandemic, and lo and behold, we are on a positive story. You know, okay, now, some part of this positive story is triumphalism. Some part of it is, you know, good old Indian hope. And some part of it is reality. And I think there is a significant amount of reality in it. Of course, there's triumphalism, propaganda, all of that going on. But there is a strong reality, which is optimism, right? Based on optimism. You see this in Bangalore. I mean, around my house, India's largest co-working tech park is opened up. All seats are full. The traffic is blocked, chock-a-block. Things are very, very optimistic. Things are energetic. And I think it's a great thing. And that's something we have to build on, right? In the sense that this optimism should not be wasted. This optimism should be channelized into demand for better services, demand for getting our act together, demand for sorting out our social service, social security system for gig workers, sort out our employment prospects for the future and so on. So optimism is a great engine to build on. Pessimism leads to a lot of defensive behavior from various stakeholders, but optimism is better, right? So I think we should not scotch the optimism. We should keep this optimism alive, grounded, but keep it alive. Now, what really is interesting here is I think that several parts of India's 21st century economy got a boost during the pandemic. I mean, look at food delivery, right? Swiggy as an example was doing fairly well. Swiggy and Zomato and the others, and Dunzo as a home delivery, were doing fairly well before the pandemic. But it was during the pandemic that people, large numbers of people, realized that how useful these services can be. This is during the pandemic that a lot of people switched from doing other jobs into the gig economy. It's during the pandemic that people figured out that you could use digital payments to accomplish the payments and so on. Now, this might be a phenomenon which is limited to the big cities and maybe some of the less bigger cities, largely an urban phenomenon. But so what? I mean, urban phenomenon doesn't mean it's something wrong with it. It's a fantastic, I mean, if it's an engine of growth, it's an engine of growth. And a lot of these things in the information age sectors like, you know, technology, in terms of hardware, software, whole lot of these modern industries, I think people have been drawn into these industries. And these industries have become globally competitive because of the cost structure and other things. And many of these industries have allowed people to work on very flexible terms, either at home, in their smaller towns and villages, thanks to national level connectivity, where you can work, you know, you could live in a small town or a village. And if you have internet connection, you can still work for your Bangalore based company. All of these have come together and created a sort of a genuine optimism engine, which will fuel the economy. Now, you could be a naysayer and say this is just a bubble, etc. You know, maybe that's true. But as I said, social constructs are something. If large numbers of Indians believe that the world is going to be a better place, we believe that India is going to be better in the next 5 to 10 years, things are looking up, they will look up. People consume more, people will buy more, people will invest more, and the economy takes off. So the economy is not a mechanical engine that works independently of human society and emotions, right? The economy is merely an abstraction of a more complex social reality, what people think and how they behave. And if people think positive and energized by the last few things, I think things will look good. And that economic growth and prosperity will spread as it is.
Yeah, so Robert Shiller's book on narrative economics exactly talks about this, right? How narratives play a role in economic booms and busts as well. So that is one angle. And I guess a couple of things which have happened is, one, the external environment for India itself has changed in the positive direction, with countries and companies looking to move out of China. And it's not still sure that India is the alternative for companies moving out of China, but yet India figures in one of the alternatives. And yet we have to do a lot of things at home, but there is definitely much more positive sentiment because of one element that the world and the companies and countries are looking at alternatives beyond China, right? So the China plus one strategy has helped.
But you know, you just called me Pitamaha at the beginning of this thing. So I might want to...
That has rattled you.
It has rattled me. But I also want to pull out the Pitamaha card and say, look, I'm old enough to remember that the world was favorably dispensed towards us in the 80s, in the 90s, in the 2000s and the 2010s, and now again in the 2020s. And if I put back a little bit of the historical hat on, I think the world was very favorably disposed towards us in the 50s, in the 1950s and the 1960s. Now, maybe the 1970s were an exception where India was not really in the flavor of the month anywhere. But for most of the post-World War II period, the West especially has wanted India to succeed. This goes against the standard anti-colonial narrative, which to some extent is true. But overall, from a society, they wanted an Indian model to succeed because they wanted to show that a poor third world complex society can succeed as a democracy politically and as a prosperous economy from an economic point of view. Right. So they wanted this to happen. Well, some of the Cold War would have confused matters a bit because the choices were not easy to make. There were multiple bases to cover. But the 90s were certainly, I remember after the reforms of Manmohan Singh and Narasimha Rao reforms, there was massive amount of positivity towards India. The Vajpayee government was another moment where the world was attracted towards India because Vajpayee went to Lahore, he wanted to, you know, make peace with Pakistan and build a new story of India that is a counterpoint to China. The last 10 years in the 2010s was again a story where the world increasingly saw as India as a counterbalance to China, both geopolitically and economically. And now it's also the case. But here's the thing. Other than in the 90s and to some extent during the Vajpayee-esque era, which is the 2000s, we did not take those opportunities. I think we had a knack of staring at the gift horse, right? And we were untrusting of the opportunities that came our way. We had some kind of instinctive anti-colonial mindsets, which was excusable in the 50s and the 60s, but I can't imagine why you would be worried about anti-colonial mindset in the 2000s or now, right? I think we are strong enough. It's a different generation in power. None of us who are in our 40s have any living memories of colonialism or British rule. And we are confident enough to take the world on our own. So I think this, as much as there is an India moment in the world out there, what worries me is that will we again stare the gift horse in the mouth and deny ourselves the opportunities that are presented to us out of some misplaced sense of insecurity, some misplaced sense of lack of confidence, some misplaced ideological prism which still is caught in the 50s and the 60s. I think we have to outgrow this and look at the world afresh and look at the opportunities are out there. Look at our strengths, which we have today. And the pandemic has shown us, right, that post-pandemic, we took a huge blow to the economy. We took a huge blow to people's life choices, but we bounced back, right? The resilience story should make us confident about the future and not be caught in traps of insecurities where always have some kind of a persecution complex. We always think that we are victims of some conspiracy or the other. I think we should outgrow this.
Yeah, true. And that has definitely been one big change that if you look at the 1990s, one thing we can talk about is how Pakistan was an overwhelming factor in Indian foreign policy, imagination, thinking, etc. But at least you can say after 2007-8, that is not the most important factor. And yet we've not taken the opportunities on various counts. So what do you think are some of the things we should be doing in this new world where there is an opportunity? There's also some zero-sum thinking, but overall, India is seen positively an engine of growth, now world's most populous country, etc. So what are some frames of references you will use in this new world?
Yeah, see, I think it's important to realize that the end state, let's say, when I say end state, the eventual order which will come, is going to be one where there will be free trade, movement of goods, ideas, people, finance across national borders. There will be, especially in an information age, come on, you're a network, right? There is nothing that a country can produce on its own. Even if you have a million engineers or 10 million engineers as we do, there are 100 million engineers outside in the rest of the world. So it's in our interest to capture the energies of those 100 million and, you know, build on the 100 million, 110 million engineers rather than just be satisfied with 10, right? So the network effects are probably much more. So that kind of an interconnected world with trades with each other, and as a consequence of it, will give importance to individual liberty, will have to give importance to human rights, will have to focus on sustainability of the planet, will have to create systems where pluralism is recognized, will have to have where war is not the normal, you know, like what Putin or Xi Jinping did, you know, going to aggressive wars, all of these are discouraged. This will happen, right? I think it is a prescription that is going to happen, you know, 10 years down the road. But the kind of policy frameworks you need for that versus the policy frameworks you need for the next 10 years, which is your period of flux or interregnum, as you called it, or this zero-sum game period, this transition period are different. So I think we'll have to be cautious in terms of how we do policy. We should not lock ourselves into a zero-sum world. Like that, for example, would be the industrial licensing, the license Raj framework, which we constructed ourselves around ourselves in the 1970s and the 80s, right? That we imprisoned ourselves thinking that the world is always going to be a closed world. And then 1991 happens and we had to liberalize, and it was a very painful process to liberalize, right? And yet we could do it. But there's no guarantee that you can liberalize every time you get that opportunity, right? So you should not lock yourself into policies that you can't replace. I think a better way to look at it is that, look, there's going to be a new dawn. We have to prepare for the new dawn. But in the time between the evening, now the night which will follow, and the dawn that will come, you need to prepare. You need to carry your, you know, torches and your emergency flashlights and everything that you, blankets for the night, because the dawn will come. So what does that mean? I think it means, at the most basic level, fix the human development issues. Fantastic education, fantastic healthcare, have a fantastic public health thing, such that when the opportunity presents itself in a few years to a young, dynamic, optimistic population, our population is equipped with skills, with knowledge, with ethical frameworks, with a grounding in Indian tradition and culture, to be able to confront that those opportunities on a positive note. But they must be prepared. You know, it's not just that the opportunity comes. You know, let's say Apple says, I want to produce the next generation of computers in India, right? And let's say the Indian workers are not able to produce to that quality. Then that opportunity is wasted, right? So you need to be able to upgrade people's skill levels such that not just the top 1% or 2% of the skilled people in the country make a living in the global economy, but 90% of India is plugged into the global economy and can take advantage of it, right? So you have to plan for that vision while keeping your powder dry during this period of flux, which basically means protecting yourself from abusive trade practices from countries like China, right? And I've always said this, that China has never done free trade to the extent that it has kept a firewall protecting its information economy from the rest of the world. It was always a protectionist country. I mean, of course, you could be trading goods and services freely across borders. But if you're close to ideas, how is it that you're a free trading country? So there are various, many other countries which have agricultural tariffs, high-tech tariffs, and tariffs on seafood and all sorts of things. So we have to protect ourselves from abusive trade, but keep ourselves open and prepared for free trade. I think there is no other country that needs an open global economy than us, because our demographic is going to be ready to take on globalized jobs, and there are globalized jobs which are going to be coming towards us for various reasons, and the investments will have to come to every other country is aging, right? We are the only country in the next 10 to 20 years that will have still a non-aging profile. We are going to be a big market. We are going to be a big labor force. So we have to plug into the global economy. So I think this is where we have to think really as nationalists. Nationalism doesn't mean I'll make everything here. Nationalism means that our people will be the most well-developed, happiest yogakshema people in the world, right? Happiness, prosperity, and well-being. We have to be the most prosperous people in the world. I don't care where the car comes from, as long as I'm prosperous and I can buy it.
No, absolutely. And on the human development part, which you said, I think this was also something which the East Asian economies were able to do, right? They were able to invest in health, education at a long period ago. And when the opportunity...
China also. China.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Despite China being under Mao Zedong and the depredations of Communist Party rule, they had fantastic human development in India.
Yeah. So he killed millions, but there some people who survived, there was still education, etc. were some things which were thought about. And when Deng Xiaoping comes, he talks about how we have to learn from the world. It goes to Japan and says that you are the teacher now and I'm the student. And, you know, there was this idea that we still have to learn from the others, and yet, and the opportunity came because they were already prepared on the human development side. So that's a great point to think about. But I also wanted to ask you, in this flux period, right? we also have to get over some of our ideological blinders, right? In the sense, given that the world is not what it was earlier, maybe we have to think of some of our priors also differently. So like we were discussing earlier on industrial policy. Now, as our base case is that there should be no industrial policy, given the fact that, you know, we know Econ 101, we know there are various difficulties that happen. But now we are in a world where every other country is doing some or the other industrial policy. Everyone is looking at, even though they know global ecosystem and that helps, everyone is trying to build a small substitute called national ecosystem in many of these things. So given that this is the world, how should we approach this in the flux period, right? So how do you think of something like industrial policy? Just as an example.
You know, I feel that you're interviewing me, Pranay, because you know this better than I do. So, but I'll still make an answer. I hope you will give me good grades for this answer. Right? So I think the macro picture is that we are not in a business as usual global economy, right? I think the global economy is undergoing a structural change. In other words, there is a restructuring of the global economy that is going on. And we should, As an Indian economy, we should restructure the global economy in a way that is advantageous to us. Similarly, there is a restructuring of the Indian economy that is going on in the post-COVID era. And whatever we are trying to do now is trying to find a better economic structure or lay down the economic structure for the information age. Mm-hmm. In that sense, it's an opportunity it's a very unique point in history where we are actually creating market structure. We are determining what kind of market we want to have in information economics or in technology or in very other. We are trying to determine that. Mm. And that's a very novel situation, right? So that is very much a situation which the state as a sovereign might want to choose. A democratic republic has an obligation to decide what kind of an economic structure it wants to have for itself and for the world. So a democratically elected government operating in a republic can therefore legitimately desire to create market structure in a way that it feels is optimum for its society. We are in that moment now. So whether it's creating, you know, digital public infrastructure, right? Whether there's a role for government in building out a whole lot of digital public infrastructure, which is Aadhaar, UPI, ONDC, the health stack, and a whole lot of things. Or in terms of bringing in new industries like semiconductors and high-tech manufacturing into the country. It is really an issue of structuring the market for the next lap. It's not business as usual. In a business as usual case, I agree. I mean, I'm probably as hardcore as a free market advocate as anybody else. Probably even more than professed free market advocates or confessed free market advocates. Yeah. But in a business as usual, yes, you shouldn't be doing industrial policy. When things are stable, you should just, you know, set the ground rules, play the role of an umpire, make sure that the playing field is level and govern for markets, right? Market competition. So competition, you just ensure there is competition and then the role of the state, you can sort of recede on other counts. But this is an exceptional moment because you get the structure wrong. You might be in a situation which is not too far-fetched where instead of having players that you control as a sovereign state, you might have market players who are beyond your sovereign control. Hmm. It could be transnational technology companies who have massive sway in your politics and society, and you have no way of controlling them. I cannot imagine a sovereign democratic republic wanting to cede this kind of power to somebody else, right? So you have to do what you need to do to ensure that your constitutional values are protected, both in terms of the way we do business, way we live, and the way we govern ourselves. Mm. And that comes from there. You do not want the power of a constitutional republic to be ceded willy-nilly to somebody else. You can't take that risk also.
Yeah, so probably we need some pragmatic approach in pursuit of the yogakshema that you mentioned. All right, so that was a great conversation about various things about assessing global realities. And this is something we are working on to think of new frameworks going ahead. And we'll probably have more ATP episodes on this in the future. Now, let's go to the listener questions, Nitin. So the first question is from Krishna, a GCPP 2016 alum. So he says that I keep hearing that economic growth is imperative and sustainability, etc., are secondary. So my question is, to get us to a per capita income of $3,000, what all should we be ready to sacrifice? The air in our cities, our health, our forests, and so on. Once we achieve this $3,000 goal, would we then be able to fix these problems, provide healthcare for respiratory diseases, cancer, etc.? Can we undo the catastrophes like the subsidence of Joshimath? Well, it's clearly a very charged up question, but the idea is, what is that threshold, right? So,
well, Krishna, actually, if you want to achieve 3,000, I don't think you need to do anything. Just stay still. The economy will reach $3,000 per capita sooner or later. I know if you're growing at 5 to 6%, you can calculate when that will happen, right? So doubling of the economy happens, I think, what, 6 years if you're growing at 7%?
It's 72 by N. So, yeah, if 7% grow, 10 years.
Yeah, so around there, you know, 5, 10 years, depending on what it is, you'll reach 3,000. 3,000 is not a difficult one, you know. I think the important target for us, when I say us, people of my generation, I'm in my mid-40s now. People for our generation, I think we should be targeting a $10,000 per capita income in the next 10, 20, 30 years as fast as possible. Because at $10,000 a year, you have a lot more resources on hand to fix your various other problems. Right. The question now, your trade-off between growth and economy becomes very, very acute because you don't have resources, right? You don't have money to pay for your energy transition. You don't have your money to pay for your plastics transition. You don't have your money to pay for any kind of adaptation which individuals have to do, right? You and I can talk about not using plastic bags because we see that as a part of a way that pollutes the environment. But a person who does not have a refrigerator at home and wants to save food for 2 days needs a plastic bag, because without a plastic bag, food spoils, in a few hours in a tropical environment like ours. So plastic bag means that bag of rice, the food that you have, can save, you know, can push for 2 days. And I think there's a massive imperative in keeping that plastic bag until we have people who depend on food of that nature, right? And we have 300-400 million people who still depend on it like that. So let's be very careful about this debate, right? Now, is there a trade-off between economic growth and sustainability? Yes. But at what level is this trade-off? Is it at the level of a city? Is it at the level of a nation? Is it a level at an international, at the global level? I think primarily we should start thinking of it from a global level. Countries that have consumed natural resources and polluted the planet for 200 years or 300 years and have benefited from that and accumulated wealth and power have the first obligation to do the transition. I'm not even talking about giving us reparations and all of that, right? Mm. You do the first cost cutting. You do the first sustainability things. Allow us to grow as fast as, this might appear to be some kind of a third world sloganeering, but that's what it is. I mean, a person with a country with a per capita income of $66,000 and a country of a per capita income of $2,000. I mean, it's not even on the same chart, you know. So I think that sustainability story is something which the West has to do, regardless of what the global negotiations say. It is an obligation that the rich countries have to do first. Let us grow up to $10,000 per annum per capita. And then I think we'll be able to do a lot of things that we can't do now. So yes, it might seem troublesome to you when framed this way, but I think the moral imperative, at least as far as I'm concerned, is the 400 million poor people who live in the country today, for whom I must do my best to give them a better life and a better tomorrow. Now, what about issues like Joshimath and all these kind of... it's not an environment versus growth thing at all. It's about being stupid. Because people who throw junk on the street, it's not an environment, a growth versus sustainability thing at all. It's a stupidity versus intelligence thing. Yeah. There's nothing which says you should throw that junk on the road. You can actually throw it in a dustbin. There's nothing which says that you should build a two-story house in an ecologically sensitive area. You can build it somewhere else. But if you're doing it because you're stupid and you're using corruption to hide your stupidity, then really it's not an environment as growth thing at all. It's an entirely different thing. It's about stupidity and, in a way, inability of many small communities and large communities to think as us with a capital U, instead of thinking of us as a small U. We must think as a big us. The moment we start thinking all of us as part of one society, these kind of solvable environmental problems will go away.
Great. So I have a couple of questions on AI. So since we are short on time, I'm not going to take those. But there are other two questions. One from Akhil Siddharth. So this is an interesting one. He asks, what are some time withstanding policy truths that are so obvious yet most people fail to recognize, to be particular in the defense sector and in the trade sector? So are there some such things?
Yeah, that's what, right? I mean, two truths, right? One in each sector I'll give you. I think the first truth in the economic sector is that voluntary exchange creates mutual prosperity. This means free trade benefits everyone, right? It's an eternal truth. I think it's as old as humanity. and it has acquired newer forms in the last 500 years. There's massive amount of empirical evidence to show that free trade benefits everybody. And as nationalists who believe in prosperity of our fellow citizens, we must stand for whatever formula gives us prosperity. And if free trade gives us that, we should back free trade. In defense, I think the most important thing to remember is that defense expenditure is the insurance against the failure of foreign policy, right? It's an eternal truth also that you put as much of effort in foreign policy and diplomacy to get what you want. But your defense expenditure ensures that your foreign policy can be successful. And if foreign policy is unsuccessful, you still have the danda to defend yourself. And what this means in practice is that you must prepare for the kind of challenges that you have. Your defense budget should go into preparing for the challenges that you will have tomorrow rather than for the challenges that you faced yesterday. But it's a well-known fact in defense policy circles that generals always fight the last war. You know, generals don't fight the next war. So again, the eternal truth is that you should fight the next war, but you end up fighting the last war. Again, moral of the story for us is look at what's going to come in the future and prepare for it.
On the trade side, I had a couple of points. One, the fact that people trade, countries don't, right? That is another thing. We feel that India is buying something, some Ganesha idols from China. It's not. People in India are trading with some people. So that's something important to keep in mind. And second, that there are no exports without imports, right? Again, one thing, we see imports so negatively that we feel we have to cut down import first. Import substitution will help us export. But that's not how the world works, especially in today's world where all there's no national industries, but global supply chains, right? So in that sense, that is one thing which I find sometimes people miss that, right? So, okay. So that was the question by Akhil. And the last question is by Akshat Jaitlia. So Akshat asks, do you think public policy as a discipline should start being taught from school? For example, one book he has mentioned, Neetopdesha. For example, books like Neetopdesha and All Things Policy are good for 11, 12 standard students. If yes, what all things should be taught in school so that they are in a position to assess the policies and make demands clearly?
Yeah, it's a very good question. You know, when I was looking at what we learn as kids in terms of policy, statecraft, we learn civics in sixth grade, which is largely about, you know, who's the president of India, how old should be the president, you know, how is separation of power. So we learn some basic civics, but it's more about how the government is structured. And then some of us who are interested read the Arthashastra and the others, which look at how the king should behave, right? Arthashastra is really a manual of statecraft. Then some of us read the Panchatantra and the Hitopadesha, etc. in Amar Chitrakatha and others. I don't think I ever read any of this in the original when I was a kid, you know. It came through us through Amar Chitrakatha, Tinkle, A Children's World, Target and other places. And they had interesting stories about morality. But only when I was much older, I read these in the original and realized these are also books for princes. The Panchatantra and Hitopadesha were written for the education of princes and how to rule. There are very few places where you can go to learn about how to be a good citizen. So, mercifully, we found the Neetopadesha. And Pranay, you've also come up with Missing in Action, which is your book, which has come out this. So, I think Neetopadesha and we can do a shameless plug for these two books. Neetopadesha and Missing in Action are two books which I think have been written for a younger generation. I think I was very happy when a kid came up to me and said, Uncle, I read the book, but I couldn't understand some parts. I said, how old are you? He said, I'm in 8th standard. So I said, oh, if you're in 8th standard and you can read most of the book, then it's great. Because I thought a 10th grader is going to be reading it. So I think there is a need to read for young people in that age group, 10th grade and above, to take an interest in public policy. You don't have to call it public policy. It's about civic leadership. It's about citizenship. It's about the morality of citizenship. And they have to be more informed about it than we were. I mean, we started thinking seriously. When I say we, my generation started thinking about it only in our late 20s and early 30s. But I think if you have an opportunity to think about it in your 10th grade and above, you will be able to do a lot for yourself and for the country and for the world. And those of us who are parents, I think it's an obligation for us to bring up our kids with a knowledge of citizenship, not just about doing IIT, JEE or NEET or, you know, CLAT and getting a high rank in a professional exam or going abroad for studies, but also to instill in them moral values relating to citizenship, not just about spiritual, you know, the spiritual aspect or the moral aspect, but also about the morality of citizenship.
Yeah, absolutely. Like we need, there's enough curriculation, but we need education, right? And that is something that we all need to think about. So with that, I would want to end this episode. So thanks so much, Nitin. Hopefully we'll do another episode when we reach 10,000. So, okay. Thank you all for listening to All Things Policy and being connected with us. And if you have any suggestions, please do send in to us. We look forward to your comments.
Yeah, bouquets and brickbats are welcome. Bouquets directed at me and brickbats directed at Pranay.
Yeah. Thank you. Bye.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle, @TakshashilaInst, or our website, takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week, Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank, and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.